Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
This is Writers on Film, the only podcast dedicated to books on cinema. Hello everybody and welcome to the Writers on Film podcast. My name's John Bleasdale, I'm a writer and critic on film, and today I'm going to be talking to David Hughes, who started off as a journalist with Empire magazine. He now writes screenplays, and somewhere in between that he wrote some brilliant books, one on Stanley Kubrick, another on David Lynch, one on greatest science fiction movies never made, and another called Tales from Development Hell, again about films that didn't quite make it to the big screen. A really fascinating topic, and we're going to cover all of those in the conversation, and I hope you enjoy it.
The weird thing is that although the Kubrick book came first, basically I had always wanted to do a book of films that never got made, and I think I probably would be very interested in a book of buildings that never got built, you know, and right. And sort of this, I've always been kind of interested in that sort of Elseworlds kind of thing. So the idea of doing a film book like that seemed to be just nobody else had done it, and I really wanted to read one, so I ended up having to write it. But I actually pitched a book about Kubrick films that had never been made, because obviously, you know, he had some famous things, the Aryan Papers and Napoleon, and, you know, there'd been a few things that he'd never got around to actually putting together. And instead, the publisher came back and said, well, actually, we want a book about Kubrick and all the films he did make. And I got to shove a section at the back about films that he didn't make. But it was through that sort of desire, I think, to make that book that I then did The Greatest Sci-Fi Movies Never Made, which was the precursor to Tales from Development Hell. And it was sci-fi in nature, I think, because the publisher was tight in books and their, you know, sci-fi was, and also because I don't think horror was really, you know, having quite the moment that it's had in the past kind of 20 years, really, at that point, and sci-fi seemed a bit more of a rich vein to mine. But I did manage to include within the greatest sci-fi movies, I did manage to include sort of superhero movies and things that were slightly, you know, wouldn't necessarily be 100% on topic. And then Tales from Development Hell was really the next edition of that book, but encompassed more than just sort of science fiction. I mean, not that it was, you know, crammed with Westerns that never got made or whatever. There was still a bias towards the genre film. Well, I mean, Westerns are genre films, but you know what I mean? There were some sort of mainstream films in there as well. But the weird thing is, after I made the first edition of Greatest Sci-Fi Movies Never Made, for whatever reason, quite a few of them actually ended up getting made, for better or worse. So you got the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy movie, you got the Thunderbirds movie, you know, a lot of the a lot of the sort of sequels, reboots and what have you that I'd put in the first book actually kind of came out, whereas that hadn't really happened with Tales from Development Hell, sadly, in some cases.
It's kind of be careful what you wish for, isn't it? There's an element of, you know, in your imagination, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy movie would be, oh, it's going to be amazing. And then in reality, it's a little bit, it's okay. You know, but it landed with a comprehensive
and you know, some of the things they kind of got right, and you could see it's like, I think that's what's so interesting in some ways about the films that the books covered, is that they are you know, the best possible version of I Am Legend, for instance, is certainly not the one that got made, although, you know, there's sort of two-thirds of it are pretty good, but then it kind of falls to pieces very quickly in the third act, unfortunately. But is the best version of that movie the unmade Ridley Scott Arnold Schwarzenegger movie, which was a little bit closer to perhaps what The Omega Man was as an adaptation of that story? And, you know, I guess we'll never know, but it's so exciting to think about films like Paul Verhoeven's Crusade and Smoke and Mirror, the kind of Sean Connery and male lead going to be, oh, Michael Douglas, Catherine Zeta-Jones in a kind of 19th century magical mystery set in the Middle East, which never got made in any way. I mean, at least you can say, well, Kingdom of Heaven had a sort of a stab at doing the Crusades, you know. But Smoke and Mirrors did seem to be the big one that got away for me.
Oh, would you say that's is there one of the films that if you had a magic ticket and you could go and see any of the unmade movies, which one would you choose?
I don't know. I know they did make I Am Legend, but I'm such a fan of that film. I think of all of them, actually, it's not. Even though, yeah, of course I would love to see for Verhoeven to have made Crusade after Total Recall, which is when it should have been made, when Schwarzenegger was the right age and everything. And I would love to have seen Smoke and Mirrors, but would any of those films really have the, you know, do I need any of those films to really exist in this universe? I don't think I do, but the one that I would have absolutely loved to have seen was Darren Aronofsky's Batman Year One, because that was so totally different to anything that, I mean, doing it as a dark 70s, you know, it's so weird that you know, the Joker kind of ended up doing this in a way, doing that Taxi Driver version. But let's say, perhaps without the artistry of perhaps what Aronofsky would have brought to it. And so I think that was one of the great missed opportunities. But then, you know, you could also argue, does the world need any more Batman films? Well, maybe we'll see with Michael Reeves, the Batman coming up.
Right,
but
yeah.
that was pretty interesting. I mean, the idea that Bruce Wayne didn't, you know, that the guy who became Batman in Darren Aronofsky's Year One didn't know that he was a Wayne. He was raised poor, worked in the garage in the basement of a guy called Al, you know, who became his Alfred kind of thing, lived across the street from a sex worker who would obviously become Selina Kyle. And it's just, it was so beautiful the way that the things knitted together. And you can see so much of the kind of DNA of that in the Joker, but it would have been done in the 90s. And just, wow, what a fantastic script that was. You know, it had some of the DNA of the Frank Miller comic Year One, because Aronofsky and Miller wrote it together, but it was kind of its own thing, and it had this kind of muscle car Batmobile that was like a souped up Ford Mustang or Dodge Challenger or something like that, but from the 70s. You know, oh man, yeah, that's the one, because I knew you were going to ask me that question, because they always do.
I know, that's brilliant. I was thinking the other day of one of the films that I would have liked to have seen, and the weird thing is, because Hollywood is such a cannibalistic sort of thing that it will recycle an idea, even if one film doesn't get made, and it'll sort of remake it something else, the way Ridley Scott sort of turns all his Dune preparation into Blade Runner. Terrence Malick wrote a script for Dirty Harry, and I just think, a Malick Dirty Harry would be good. But then they took the main idea of his script, which was basically Harry Callahan going against the vigilante cops, and they made it into Magnum Force anyway. So you kind of have this sort of Terrence Malick version of Dirty Harry in existence. It's just, you don't know. You know, it's just, it's been hidden by the layers that have accrued.
on
top of it. What about...
I just wanted to say it was really interesting that Total Recall 2, which you not one of the sort of the great unproduced movie stories, but just kind of to your point, 100%, they were going to do a Total Recall sequel that happened to be based on the story The Minority Report from Philip K. Dick. And the idea was the precogs from Minority Report had been kind of established. They would be the sort of the Martian, you know, there were all of those elements. And I think what happened is Gary Goldman, who'd written Total Recall, he explained this to me at length, but it was kind of 20 years ago now, so I'm a little bit rusty on some of the details, but he basically had suggested that the Minority Report would be an excellent basis for where the Arnold Schwarzenegger character gets accused of a crime that he hasn't yet committed because the precogs, you know, so it's basically always kind of bundled up into a Total Recall sequel. And of course, it advanced quite far, and Total Recall was like a big hit. So, but then it actually sort of evolved back into a standalone Minority Report film. And so none of that stuff kind of got wasted. And when I look back at the Planet of the Apes films that never got made, I do see strands of them in, even going back to 1988, when Adam Rifkin, he of Mouse Hunt fame, when he wrote a Planet of the Apes script, when Fox was first considering rebooting Planet of the Apes, 1988, you know, it's a long way before Tim Burton got around to doing his kind of reimagining. And he basically come up with the idea of ditching all of the Planet of the Apes sequels, which I thought personally was a bit rude because I really like the Planet of the Apes sequels. You know, each has its merits, even though none of them are the towering as the original. And what he did is he said, well, what if we ignore all the sequels? Because what people really remember about Planet of the Apes is that, you know, there are apes, Charlton Heston and the Statue of Liberty at the end. You know, what if we forget all those sequels and just kind of do a sequel to the original 1968 Planet of the Apes, and then you can sort of bring that back. And that's kind of what he did. And then I thought, oh my god, that's what they've done with like Halloween. And it took a long time for Hollywood to realize that they could actually and Terminator, you know, they could actually reboot these things and ignore whichever sequels are inconveniently bad or unsuccessful and do whatever the hell you like. You know, it's so weird that we were so rigid with the rules kind of 20-30 years ago.
But at the same time, it's sort of at that point you think, well, where would it stop? Would you sort of do... I wrote a satirical article once called Moonraker 2, you know, announcing the news of they're going to make a sequel to Moonraker? That'll never work, you know? inserting sequels to Bond films in between Bond films because they run out of titles. They run out of good titles. So let's do a Thunderball 2 instead of... right. Spectre or something.
But you know, you can kind of see it, and one of the things I think is quite exciting is that when you're in the era that's the sort of the post-postmodern era where new treatments of original of previous ideas have already sort of been done, now what you're doing is kind of, and at the most cynical end of that, you can see the kind of the mini Stay Puft men in the new Ghostbusters, which are clearly everybody's trying to make Minions, you know, because the Minions were so successful. So, you know, those kind of hideous sort of cynical things, but you can sort of ignore those and say, well, then, you know, that's not for me. So I'm not too worried about, you know, that kind of silliness. You know, you don't embrace the cynicism. But then there are other times when it's like, you literally, you've had like 7 bad sequels, but now here's a really good one. And you sort of all is forgiven and you don't mind. I mean, I had kind of high hopes when I read Chris Rock was doing a Saw movie or something. I was like, yeah, you know, bring it on, because it's all good, you know, whatever you want to do. They did 6, maybe 5 sequels to Wrong Turn, and then the latest one, which has got the same title as the original, sort of gets it right, and in a really interesting and exciting way, I thought, that turns the whole sort of idea on its head, that it's not the savages in the backwoods, it's actually, they are actually quite civilized, and we are the savages, you know, I mean, it's...
Cannibal not, Holocaust, you know. Dale and Tucker...
right.
Evil, sort of.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly. So it's kind of. I think it's a kind of an exciting and time to kind of be still a fan of cinema, but at the same time you do have to kind of take the rough with the smooth. You know, you have to take the Ocean's 8 with that with another interesting reboot that's been done recently. I mean, you know, it's such a big gulf between Batman and Robin and Batman Begins, that when Batman Begins came out, it was like so incredibly exciting. It reminded me of when Batman came out in 1989, and you didn't want to sort of piss all over the you know, Adam West and Burt Ward, but it was so profoundly different and new. It was like super exciting. And then after a while, you kind of get bored with those films as well. And then by the time The Dark Justice, or whatever the hell that rubbish that is called, comes along, Dawn of Justice and the, you know, the dark Batman, and you're just like, nah, you know, I'm tired of that now. And now I want to be doing the more colourful sort of Marvel thing. And then Marvel goes dark and kills off literally 50% of its IP in one film, which is still, I think, the most amazing thing that's ever happened in cinema.
I was
in
so
cinema,
disappointed, you know, when I found out that there was a second film. I went to see that with my daughter, and I thought, that is such a good ending. And she went, oh yeah, there's a part two. And I was like, what? I was so like, oh, no! You
know, like, oi, Feige, no! Yeah, it is an amazing thing. I mean, imagine if the film that brought all the Disney princesses together killed off half of them and then made you wait a year for the... I mean, even the fact that they did it, we know that in the Death of Superman comics that Superman's going to come back at some point. But it's just such an amazing thing to do in a movie where there's so much at stake. If you fuck it up in a comic, it's not that expensive to put it right again, and you can just sort of do it, you know, because obviously the illustrations cost more or less the same, no matter how big the production value. But when you do that in a movie, it's, you know, massive kind of risk to take, and it's so that has been an amazing thing to witness as well. So anyway, we're getting off the topic of films that didn't get made.
no, that we don't have to stick to any given topic. I'm interested about this idea of sort of trying to the sort of evolution of the sequel, really, because you go back to, we were talking on Twitter the other day about Jaws 2, and that's, you know, I rewatched that recently. It's not that bad, you know. It's not as good as Jaws by a long stretch, but it's got a decent poster. It's got a great tagline, and it's got Roy Scheider. Who's the other guy in it? The guy who plays the mayor, is it Murray Hamilton? But in the 1980s, the idea of a sequel was considered really naff, and they were going to, you know, you're going to take a bath on it, so you're going to make it cheaper because you're never going to make the same amount of money. You know, you're always going to make less. Nowadays, it's the opposite, where the sequels seem to be gaining more and more, and frequently, even if they're inferior in quality, they still make a bucket load of cash.
Yeah, and I think what really drove that was the international market became the tail that wagged the dog, obviously. And then what happens is, you know, recognition is so important. And it's also that, I mean, this is a bit of an old kind of an old idea now, but the idea that if you'd missed the first one on its theatrical release, but you'd caught up with it on home video, which is obviously, you know, kind of a new thing that came through that really sort of exploded in the 80s. And then obviously, you know, it had the kind of the DVD revolution in the late 90s. The idea being that now there were so many more people that were aware of this thing that the sequel was going to be bigger because more people would want to see that theatrically. Whereas even through the kind of the first run of sort of Star Trek movies, that didn't really happen. You'd have an anomaly like a Star Trek 4 or something that would suddenly make some money, and then the next one would kind of flop again. And you could never really guarantee that it was they were going to get bigger as they went along. But the big ones certainly do seem to follow that pattern pretty well. So
there was also sort of there was a trend, and I'm not sure if this has kind of stopped, but there was a trend of making two sequels at the same time. I think there was Back to the Future was the first that did that, where you had two and three made back to back or more or less at the same time. And then you had Lord of the Rings, of course. You had the Matrix films that were made at the same time. I think the Pirates of the Caribbean filmed the two sequels more or less simultaneously. But I'm not sure if that doesn't seem to be happening. And in fact, the latest Star Wars trilogy that's just come out, from the recent thing that J.J. Abrams came out with, seemed like, oh, we hadn't bothered writing a story. You know, we didn't... I mean, what the hell were they thinking? I mean, it kind of gladdens my heart in a way, because it makes me think, oh, well, good. If you guys are this sort of incompetent, then there's hope for me yet.
that's a good way to look at it. I think it's for me, that was like, you know, I understand that you could sort of go into something like Lost and not necessarily know how you were going to get out. But when Marvel's MCU has been built in the way that it was, even though there were a few sort of, you know, missteps and a couple of things that you know, withered on the vine. Generally speaking, that thing is a juggernaut that kind of kept going. I don't think you really have an excuse not to map it out properly. And that did make me feel like, if you're not going to do it for Star Wars, do you know what I mean? What are you going to do that for? And Star Trek kind of thing went a little bit that way as well. It was a bit of a damp squib at the end of it, whereas the reboot itself seemed to be phenomenally well thought out, and then where it went from there just was not a good place, you know?
It reminds me of Charles Dickens, who used to write his novels, and his beginnings are always great because he's so excited, but they used to overlap. He would get hired to write, okay, I'm due another novel, so he'd be starting Tale of Two Cities before he finished Oliver Twist, and so the end of Oliver Twist will be a bit like, yeah, and they all get happy ever after, and then, because I'm more excited about this other project, and J.J. Abrams feels a little bit like that he's like, Star Trek now, oh no, Star Wars, oh no,
yeah, that's a good analogy. I feel like there are filmmakers who wouldn't necessarily be that sort of, you know, mercurial with, you know, somebody like you know, Christopher Nolan or Christopher McQuarrie would sort of say, no, I'm going to do this and I'm going to do it properly, and then we'll kind of see how, you know, see how that works out, and not get distracted by sort of, you know, other projects or spread themselves too thin kind of thing. But
yeah, but I mean, a treatment for three movies, we're talking about 10 A4 pages. We're not talking about, you know, somebody who has to have every shot planned.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But just know where your destination is. One of the things I was going to say, actually, to pick up what you were saying about people kind of getting attached to things, and it reminded me of that, the kind of period when, which I think has been happening a little more in television now, where you can't sort of do a big thing unless you've got like a Ryan Murphy or a David Benioff, or, you know, it's got somebody who's got some clout to be the kind of showrunner. And it's why you see these kind of superstar showrunners now. But there was a period when film studios were kind of just keen to sort of attach somebody who would at least give them like something. This is even before the cast come on board. They would want to attach like a big executive producer or something. And it's how you ended up with, you know, James Cameron's Planet of the Apes or Oliver Stone's Planet of the Apes or something like that. And it was literally just somebody who's going to take $1 million to just put their name on something so that the studio can kind of kick it along the road a little bit. And I haven't actually done the analysis of whether any of those projects kind of ended up in a good place because of a big sort of, you know, heavyweight that came on board, because we kind of know what happened with James Cameron's Spider-Man, that it was kind of a really exciting and interesting potential combination of actor and, you know, if it had been like Leonardo DiCaprio or something, and, you know, James Cameron doing that. Those kind of films that never got made, which I also cover in the course of the books, I kind of never really went beyond the sort of the treatment stage. But to me, it's exciting just the fact that those people were involved in those projects. And, you know, John Borman doing Lord of the Rings, or Ridley Scott doing I Am Legend, as I mentioned before, or Ridley Scott doing the Hot Zone with Robert Redford and Jodie Foster. And I can't believe that I was the only guy doing books about films that never got made. But I guess I just carved out a niche, and that's the way it happened. And luckily for me, because I had no sort of experience of really writing books each, because they were sort of broken into chapters, which books are handily, I discovered. All I had to do was really write like 12 or 13 really long articles. And I had a book. So it was not that difficult to transition from writing articles for Empire and stuff, you know.
So you started writing for Empire before you went over to, well, I mean, you do, I assume you're doing both, basically.
Well, yeah. I mean, I did. I'd been writing for Empire for 10 years by the time I got the first book out the gate. Right. And I'd been writing proposals for probably six or so years. And basically,
what were some of your best proposals that never got made?
You could do
a book about that.
You know what? I really couldn't. I couldn't remember. The only one I could remember was the Kubrick, the unproduced Kubrick films, because that's the one that led to the one that did get made. So I couldn't remember what the other ones were. But yeah, I mean, they probably weren't very good. And sometimes I would put together a proposal for a book, and then I'd find that somebody else was actually working on it, and I'd think, oh, thank God, because now I don't have to write the damn thing. You know, like I think I tried to buy a book. I didn't really want a book about Kubrick himself, because I had that book. I had a biography. What I wanted was like a book about Kubrick and his films, you know, like the same way that you might do, well, Tom Schoen did the Christopher Nolan book that wasn't really about Christopher Nolan's life, because that's not what Christopher Nolan was interested in. And I kind of knew about Kubrick, the person, but I was much more interested in learning about his films. And sort of in a similar vein, I didn't think there was much biographical juice in David Lynch's backstory, which was the book I worked on after, right, after the Kubrick one. They sort of, and then I did kind of the greatest sci-fi movies never made in between. But then I think the next project was Virgin, who were publishing The Complete Range, and they came to me and said, do you want to do Cronenberg or Scorsese? And I thought, oh God, that's a really tough choice, because I probably find more personal interest in Cronenberg's oeuvre at that point. But Scorsese, how could you, you know, resist doing a book about Scorsese if somebody asked you? And then I think it was my wife who said to me, when are you going to like stop writing films about other people and start writing films like of your own? And I suddenly thought, oh my God, I've been wasting my life writing books about other people. I should be writing screenplays. And that's literally how I transitioned to writing scripts, which is kind of what I've been doing instead of writing books these past 20 years or so. So right, that's kind of So I basically transitioned from writing articles for Empire with no like qualifications beyond the fact that I was the first guy to phone in when issue one came out and say, hello, can I write for you? and that's literally how I got that job, and I'm still there.
That's how they still hire, apparently. That's exactly the same thing. You just have to phone up. Have to find the phone number. That's the
right,
the
only, if you the pass that test. Exactly. But it was literally, I mean, 1989, they published issue one, and I think it was like the first couple of issues were bi-monthly. I literally called, I phoned the office, you know, with no qualifications whatsoever, and said, oh, how do I get to like write reviews for you? They said, well, have you seen anything? We haven't. And I said, well, no, but I will. And then they said, right, okay, we'll do that and then call back. And so I basically flew to Paris that weekend, because they used to release films in Paris a lot, you know, they would get an early release. This is right, literally 1989. So you could go and see the, you'd look in the little Paris matchbook, you know, and it would say version originale, and you'd know that you, if you don't speak French, you can still kind of watch the film. And I saw like a whole bunch of, I spent the whole weekend on the Champs-Élysées, basically watching, going from one cinema to another. Came back on Monday with a pencil and said, right, I've seen this, 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 and this. And they say, right, we'll have the fly to get us, you know, 500 words by Monday or whatever, and 40 quid. And I was off to the races. And that was it. And then, because Empire was so new, once you write for Empire magazine, you could basically get in anywhere, because it was like the golden ticket to you know your shit about movies, at least, you know, mainstream films. I wasn't doing like Cahiers du Cinéma or Sight and Sound, and never have, because I'm, you know, I'm not smart enough for that. For that type of thing. Meanwhile, I'm over here analysing, you know, Kubrick and Lynch films.
I do Sight and Sound, David.
To the proper writers, and I do, you know, which is the second best film in the MCU. So
you do the fun stuff.
Well, you know, the thing is, I do get to do kind of what I like, and what I like for the past sort of decade or so has really been writing scripts, you know, for hire. And you know, my dream job is basically for someone to give me a book and say, you know, come back in 6 weeks with a script based on this book, and sort of breaking it down and doing that. Because I think maybe it comes out of that purity of the blueprint for a film that you never actually saw and wasn't at the mercy of all of the myriad problems that films face when they're actually being made. The script for that unmade, you know, Batman Year One movie is so perfect that the film itself couldn't possibly kind of hold up to it in a way. And in the same way, getting to write the first, yeah, I mean, I wrote the first draft of Escape from Pretoria. I met the guy who escaped from Pretoria, and breaking the book, being the first person to take the memoir and turning it into a film script is always kind of like such an exciting part of the process. And I kind of much prefer that to the end game, which is here's a script we're just about to go into production with, but it needs like final polish or something. And then there's only so much you can do in the, I mean, in fact, I once got asked to rewrite a film that had already been shot, which was the Paul Schrader version of The Exorcist, what became The Dominion.
Oh, really?
And it was Friday afternoon. I got called into Morgan Creek, and they said, we've got Rennie Harlin, and he's going to be coming in like next month to shoot like the other bits of the film because we didn't like it. So can you write all those bits? But we can't really change any of the bits that he's already done. So that Paul Schrader's done. So you're going to have to kind of, so like, what a fascinating project would be.
A writer's version of Saw. You sort of stuck in the room. There's an escape room.
Absolutely. And obviously you can cut stuff, but you can't really reshoot stuff that's already been shot because they've only got a certain amount of budget for new stuff. And they want that stuff to be sort of scary special effects. So, but they also wanted it to link to the original Exorcist in a way that the,
Did your work end up going into the finished project?
No, it didn't. But you know, I had great meetings about it. And, you know, got paid for the work that I did. But what was fascinating about it is that I'd written the thing that they'd read of mine was actually like a comedy about two guys who have to drive the world's most expensive car across America in 24 hours. And they read that and they said, oh, yeah, we think you'd be good to do the Exorcist prequel. I'm like, what? How does that work? And then at the end of the meeting, when I sort of couldn't kind of, you know, fuck it up anymore, basically, I just said, do you mind if, can I just ask, why would you bring me in for this? And they said, oh, you can write.
Right.
And that's it. That's what they care about. They're not, you, for all that the reputation is, oh, they want to put you in a pigeonhole or whatever. Actually, they just want, like, that was a good thing what I wrote then. It would look terrible now if I look back on it. But back then it was okay. And lots of people, you know, I got lots of kind of meetings out of it, but some bizarre stuff comes out of it and you never know what's going to suddenly take off.
I remember talking to a literary agent once who was letting me down very gently from a rejection, and he said, everybody says you have to have all these rejections and there's so many manuscripts are sent and we can only, you know, and all the rest of it, but of all those manuscripts that are sent, 1% are good enough and the rest are just like there's a continental shelf of quality. And he sort of said, you're in that 1%. You know, you're just not, for me, you're not there, but you're in that 1%. And it was kind of like, it sort of gives you hope. Yes, there are millions of people out there writing. Luckily, most of them are not that good. You know? And it's just like, even the most basic stuff.
Yeah, it is amazing. I mean, I think the introduction to one of my books basically says this is kind of how the math works. It's that like of 1%, of all the scripts that get started, only 1% get finished. Of all the scripts that get finished, only 1% is ever read by somebody with any kind of, you know, ability to do anything with it, you know, and it's probably much less than 1% actually. But, and of all the scripts that get read by somebody, only 1% is going to get financed or whatever. And so every script that gets made is basically a million to one shot. So if you've, I mean, I've, you know, I had one feature made out of the maybe 13 to 15 that I've kind of written, most of which have sold or been optioned at one point or another. And obviously it's different if they're coming to you with a book and saying, you know, here you go, adapt this kind of thing. But you know, so the numbers are massively against you in every way. But I do see that's starting, that the gatekeeping is starting to go away now, and that social media has opened up such an amazing method for talent to out, that there's just no way that talent will go undiscovered in the next kind of for the next generation, because you can get noticed very, very quickly. And you know, Hollywood of course has always jumped on whatever looks like the hot shit of that particular day kind of thing. So it's just that the churn is so much faster now. But when you get somebody who comes in and says, hey, here's a moribund franchise that you've got knocking around Lionsgate or whatever, you know, I've got an idea to juice it, they're going to say, well, sure, you know, we'll give it a punt, because really it costs nothing for them to spend that money developing another script. I mean, I remember how shocked me and my co-writer were when we found out that we weren't the only people working on this particular idea for this director. And then I look back now and I marvel at my own naivete, because I wrote bloody books about screenwriters who'd been asked to, you know, when they were figuring out what to do with Batman, they like asked so many different people. It wasn't just Darren Aronofsky. Or whoever was hot at Sundance that week, they would say, what's your take? You know, and obviously lots of people have meetings about projects and they're always these mad kind of ideas. To be honest, one of the reasons why I haven't really done a full third edition of Tales from Development Hell, although I did sort of, you know, refresh the book and did a second edition, is that I haven't really fallen in love with any of the stories of films that haven't got made to the point where you could write like a really big juicy chapter about it. Because even in the case of At the Mountains of Madness by Guillermo del Toro, you know, his adaptation of the classic H.P. Lovecraft story, I feel that story's been out there now because of podcasts and you know, interviews and what have you. It feels like I would really just be compiling, you know, rather than doing the sort of the raw research. And I feel that he's kind of told that story. So maybe I'll stumble on a couple of stories that will make me feel like I really want to dig into it and get enough material to do like another book. But then again, hopefully script or two will come along in the meantime. And obviously now you've covered this a little bit with what you were talking about with Tom, but you really have to be sure now that you've got like a shit hot idea before anybody will actually put it into print. And so the lavishness of the books that are coming out for filmmakers now that will put like a, you know, £30 plus price tag. There are very few directors in who are going to be worthy of that. And the amount that you're going to get paid for is not really enough to live on. So you're having to do these things as labors of love around other projects. And when you've got a commitment to a publisher, you can't suddenly go off and write a film script for, you know, 3 months or whatever, you know. So I haven't really found anything that I've wanted to do that was new. And besides, I kind of like my niche, you know, doing the so I may just endlessly refresh and update those because I find those exciting. So I mean, Crusade, you know, recently the rights to Crusade got optioned or got bought from Arnold Schwarzenegger, who had got in a settlement deal or had picked them up at the fire sale, the Carolco fire sale, and had sort of hung on to those rights over all those years. And now someone else owns it, and who knows, they may revive it and bring it back. But there's always kind of life in some of those long dead projects, as we've seen from just some of the content that's come out over the past 20 or so years.
Well, I want to come back to that, so let's put a pin in that for a second. But one question I wanted to ask was, after doing Tales from Development Hell, which is full of stories of writers being, you know, kind of, excuse my French, shafted, what then made you think, follow your wife's advice and go, I want to be that guy. I want to have the bottom bunk of the prison cell, please.
Well, it's because what I really didn't want to do was direct. So I think that was the kind of the natural way to sort of make films and always be able to like blame the other guy. And, you know, my old character.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Writer that I used to collaborate on some of my projects with, he said, oh, that's because you haven't written anything that you're so in love with you couldn't bear anybody else to direct it. And I was like, no, it's pretty much that my visual sense kind of ends on the page and doesn't necessarily translate to the stage, you know. No, I couldn't imagine kind of doing that. And I think also, you know, writing those blueprints, you've got a lot more freedom to kind of, I write quite fast, generally speaking, and I've got a lot, you know, there's a lot more stuff that I can produce in a shorter amount of time. And also kind of like, I've always worked to order. I mean, my day job is kind of running a marketing agency for films that I've been doing that for 30 years now as well. And my own company's been going for 15 years as of April. So basically, you know, making trailers and TV ads and promos and digital assets and posters and what have you for films is kind of one, wearing sort of one hat. And then I guess that because I was always working with somebody else's raw materials when I was making trailers, you're always given a film or whatever, or if I was doing an article, it was about somebody else. This was kind of my way, screenwriting was kind of my way to build the story from scratch, or if it wasn't built from scratch, then to take a book or you know, in some of the best cases, somebody else's idea that they would kind of pitch to me. And I would say, great, I'll go away and do the first draft of that idea, you know, if someone comes up with. And yes, there were a lot of, to come back to your question, there were a lot of horror stories in that book, but all of those horror stories tended to be told by people who were living in gorgeous apartments in Malibu or the Palisades or whatever. So, you know, they got paid very, very well to be treated so badly. And in the scheme of things, they're not like children mining lithium from the ground in Sierra Leone or whatever. I mean, they're being treated poorly on a curve.
Very relative, yeah. Very, very relative form of poverty when he's all like three Ferraris.
Yeah, but when you look back at some of those stories and you realise the pain that those people have gone through. I mean, I have experienced that pain on my own sort of small level. And when people make those, I mean, one of the sad things, I guess, was when I realized that William Shatner had aged out of the T.J. Hooker Jr. movie that I wrote for the creator of T.J. Hooker, who basically hired me to write an A-Team, 21 Jump Street, whatever type reboot. But T.J. Hooker would be in it as, you know, played by William Shatner.
Right.
But his bumbling son would have just graduated from the police academy with as basically the sort of the shit Kennedy son, if you like. So his father was this incredible legend and obviously, you know, played with tongue firmly in cheek by William Shatner, but played completely straight. And he would be the sort of the bumbling idiot who, of course, comes good at the end. And oh, man, when I realized that actually that just was not possible for the simple reason that William Shatner had to be in it and he could no longer get insured for action scenes because he past the age of 80, it was like, and it just was gone forever. And I did really, and not that I had high hopes that it would get made, but just for nothing to come of it, for it never to appear in any form. I mean, that, you know, that did hurt.
Nothing that you could transform or in some way sort of make it into something else.
Yeah, exactly. It had to have that. I mean, not that, you know, I mean, of all the IPs that you could be given, this wasn't the dream.
Oh,
you know what
on.
I mean?
TJ Hooker's pretty high up there. I mean, a little bit below Manimal, but, you know.
But, you know, I was happy to take it.
Do Airwolf.
Yeah, exactly. And I was excited. And just the idea that they sort of, well, that one, yeah, I know we're not really here to talk about screenwriting, but that was, I particularly cherished that one because it was one that I kind of, they didn't want me and I kind of fought for it and got it.
Right.
You know, so
did you
that
have any meetings
of,
with Shatner?
No, I didn't. I was meeting with Rick Husky, who was the T.J. Hooker guy, and the producer who was actually going to sort of be the producer for the film, who had actually, I can't remember what his name was, but who had actually done like big films. And so, you know, you could sort of get this set up at whichever studio owned the rights, which I think was Universal. So, I mean, there were a few experiences like that along the way. And it was quite indulgent of me to, in the second edition of Tales from Development Hell, I did add a chapter which described my own sort of, and now if I do a third edition, which honestly, I am about halfway through third edition at the moment, I wouldn't include that chapter now because I realize that other people's tales from Development Hell are much more interesting than mine, and mine are actually fairly humdrum by comparison to these kind of giant movies that never saw the light of day but will always fascinate in the mind, you know.
What about movies which have sort of been long delayed or long gestated to the point that they look like they'll never turn up? I'm thinking of Terry Gilliam's The Man Who Killed Don Quixote, which I saw really recently, And I'd seen the La Mancha documentary, Lost in La Mancha, and I'd seen the He Dreams of Giants documentary. And I saw, I actually quite liked it. It was weird. It was kind of a weird thought experiment trying to think, well, if I just watched this without any of that, how would I have felt towards it? I think I probably would have liked it as just a better than average Terry Gilliam movie.
That's really interesting. And yet you can't. You know, that you just can't divorce yourself from all of that baggage that you kind of bring to it, in the same way that sometimes you can cast an actor because of what the audience brings to, you know, they do so much. And when it's that's why, you know, I guess casting against type is kind of so interesting, because, like, I don't know, Robin Williams in 1 Hour Photo or whatever, everything that the audience brings, they're not allowed to use, you know, so you've got an extra level of, so yeah, I don't think you can ever get around that. But then I think probably it's one of those cases where there is a perfect time to have made Crusade, and it was then, and there was a perfect, there was a great Planet of the Apes reboot, but I'm not sorry that they did the Mike Reeve version, because it was so good. I don't know whether what many of the great things in the Smoke and Mirrors script would have been great beyond the period in which it would have been made. So there are films like that that needed to be made in their time. And I guess, you know, one of the disappointments is that when the moment passes and you know that can't happen anymore, all you really have is the things that never were. And I still find that really exciting. And you know, if, like I say, if I could find enough interesting projects to make another sort of full volume of the book, I definitely would, because I feel like that's where I'm most, where I'm the happiest, is exploring never was and things that kind of nearly made it but never quite off the ground. I think one of the most soul crushing things is perhaps the fact that when Guillermo del Toro said he didn't make At the Mountains of Madness because Prometheus had basically done it, that was like, oh, because right. I would have so much rather had Guillermo del Toro's At the Mountains of Madness, because, you know, the H.P. Lovecraft and Guillermo del Toro, and he'd been building up to an amazing H.P. Lovecraft movie, and he had like Tom Cruise and, you know, all this incredible stuff. It just could have been amazing. And then for him just to say, but thematically it's been done now, and then you have to wait like another 10 years before you can sort of do that again, and nobody will notice that it's quite a bit like Prometheus. And so it all kind of feeds on itself. And I guess that's called John Carter syndrome, isn't it, that by the time you actually get around to making the John Carter movie, the corpse has been picked clean.
Yeah, like the lady said when she watched Hamlet, I liked it, but it's full of quotes. I mean, the thing about I love about Lovecraft is I love the setting, the date. You know, I mean, it's contemporary to Lovecraft. He's writing contemporary stuff for him, but, you know, that 1920s, you know, sort of interwar period, I just think is so atmospheric and great. I guess The Mummy sort of had a little bit of that sort of atmosphere, the sort of Brendan Fraser version. You know, I like Reanimate and From Beyond and all that schlock, but it's not really H.P. Lovecraft, is it?
Yeah, that's the problem. You kind of want, and there have been other subsequent, you know, but I think what you want is an absolutely set in the period, pure, true to the spirit of the stories, kind of a Dunwich horror, which I guess they got kind of a little bit close. I mean, Brian Usner and Stuart Gordon, between them, they did have a really good crack at it, but they never quite got that, the combination of the budget, the atmosphere. You need a director to come along who worships H.P. Lovecraft and wants to do it, in the same way that directors have come along and writers have come along who worship Stephen King and want to do Stephen King right. And I do believe that it will happen, but it will probably be, you know, we'll be in the sort of the late 2020s, which will be 100 years after the stories were written. And hopefully somebody will come along with that kind of love, as they did for Stephen King over the last kind of 10 years or so, where we've seen these amazing adaptations of Stephen King's stories that have been done before, but that sort of poorly, but also the massive influence that Stephen King has had over things like Stranger Things and you know, other things that we see now that we know bear the telltale sort of imprint of his, you know, of his influence.
I think they should have had Peter Jackson and Del Toro should have swapped films. I think Del Toro should have done The Hobbit like he was supposed to, and Peter Jackson should have done Mountains of Madness.
Right.
You know, it's like he did with King Kong. It was a sort of, and he had the background in horror, and
That's a good thought. You see, there's a whole book there on films that should have been that weren't even mooted, but this would have been a good person to do that project.
Right. Let's do swapsies.
Yeah.
I was thinking as well, because living in this sort of Never Never Land of projects that didn't quite make it off the ground or made it very close to the air but didn't ever get properly made, there's always a price, that there's always that invisible price. So if James Cameron makes Spider-Man, he doesn't make the film that he's then gonna make.
That's
so
true.
It sort of becomes a trade-off as well. Would you swap this for that? Would you swap Total Recall 2 for what did Verhoeven do? Showgirls and Basic Instinct, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, that's a really good thought. I don't know why I've never thought about that, but you've made a really good point. Yeah, you have to give up something, don't you, in order to get the thing. And I think in a lot of cases, it probably wouldn't be worth losing. I mean, I definitely think that if Cameron had made Spider-Man, there wouldn't have really been any reason for Sam Raimi to do it when he did it. Do you know what I mean? So we'd have to sort of give up those things. And I know that not all of those films turned out super great, but there's enough kind of really good stuff in there to make you think that maybe the planet kind of did, you know, maybe we do live in the best of all possible universes, even though we didn't get to see those films that we've kind of discussed, you know, and waiting for the right Lord of the Rings to come along and the right person to do it and the right budget and the right. And I think, you know, one of the reasons why some of these things shouldn't have happened when they didn't is because special effects weren't ready. I mean, that's really what the whole thing with waiting for Avatar, you know, for better or worse or what have you, the way that the Planet of the Apes films were done when they were done, you know, the reboot, they were so brilliant because they were able to get the characters to be the way they were. It was just, they had to be done in that time and would have looked a bit rubbish if they were done when they were meant to be done. So that's a very good point. It's not just the trade-off, it's all the fact that they probably would have been diminished by the fact that the special effects hadn't caught up to where they needed to be yet.
Yeah, I think John Boorman's Lord of the Rings sounds... Yeah, I'd be kind of terrified of that. I think it would be like a Zardoz. It would be a magnificent mess.
Because all you'd really have would have been sort of costumes and maybe one fairly pricey special effect. You know, maybe you'd throw everything at one big effect because that's what those films kind of tended to do.
Lightning and, you know.
Yeah, so we were spared that. I mean, not that I would mind. If I heard that a bootleg of... had been found and it was coming out on Blu-ray, I would definitely be first to pre-order it, you know, with all its sort of crappy bits.
I mean, in a way as well, this is also perhaps something about the physical media that I'm guessing that we might be, you're probably a bit younger than me, but we're probably around the same age. So I'm guessing you grew up with... You're looking quizzical. You don't want me.
Well,
to
I came out the same year as I came out the same year as Planet of the Apes and 2001: A Space Odyssey. I was born in 1968, so I'm.
Oh, right. Okay.
Reckon I'm a bit older than you.
Yeah, you are. You're so youthful. I assumed that I was the relic.
But what was the point that you were going to make anyway?
Oh, God knows. No, I remember. Yeah. When you said there's a bootleg about the John Boorman Lord of the Rings, that feels like a throwback to when I used to watch a dodgy recording of Clockwork Orange on video cassette, which was obviously sort of filmed from a TV in Holland and smuggled into the country. So there's this sort of sense that there were these sort of impossible movies hiding out there somewhere, which kind of doesn't exist anymore. I feel that I know about a movie well in advance of it appearing. The common complaints about the trailers showing too much and this, that and the other.
Yeah.
The rampant speculation, which even if fans don't know. I mean, I'm guilty of this myself. I wrote an article about Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, which basically guessed pretty accurately what was going to happen. So
right.
which I took a bit of pleasure in it, I guess. But you know what I mean? There's the element of the space for that kind of mystery is a little bit narrower than it was in the 80s and 70s. I mean, I remember walking into movies and just going, "What's this?" You know, it's
Indiana definitely, Jones and. You know, when I think back to kind of how I used to experience a lot of, you know, movies and TV, it was basically because you couldn't like afford to go to the movies as often as you wanted to, and you had no home video, and the films that were on TV you had to wait 5 years to see. Basically, the ways that we re-experienced films were like novelizations. If you were very lucky, photo novelizations, which were basically frames of the film.
I want to do an episode on novelizations. I really want to do.
I mean, they're just crazy. Philip Kaufman sent me the photo novelization of Invasion of the Body Snatchers, and after I interviewed him as kind of a thank you. It was an amazing thing, and it was like such an amazing relic from a bygone age, because I had forgotten that they existed, but then I remembered that years ago that was my video, that or a cassette recorder taping Tom Baker Doctor Who off the TV so I could listen back to it later or whatever. That was the only way that you could sort of re-experience things. And then, of course, you know, if you could get hold of film magazines that would go a bit deeper, like if you were lucky enough to be able to get a Ciné Fantastique or something like that, then you could really take a deep dive behind the movies. Of course, that would be the equivalent now of just kind of re-watching it on DVD. But to your point about whether or not it's possible to find hidden movies, I think it is. But what you'd have to uncover now is a script that you didn't know had been written for a film that didn't get made. And that's where I think that may be a scene that hasn't been fully mined, because there are quite a few, like we were talking about, like the filmmakers who were offered like a to write their take on a Batman film or something. Those things are kind of can be dug up, you know, and these scripts do surface from time to time, and occasionally you'll see, oh, here's the original, the guy who wrote the original draft of The Truman Show when it was set in New York and sort of didn't have the comedic elements that come naturally with putting Jim Carrey in it, and it wasn't the Peter Weir version of it. It was Andrew Nichols hated the film that they made and would love to have his version of that out there. And I think, as we've seen with like the audio dramatization of Alien 3, one of the Alien 3, William Gibson's version, I think got made as an audio drama. And I think we've seen a couple of unmade films turn up as like graphic novels or whatever. If there's money in it, I think the studios will start to mine that catalog of stuff and realize that they've got content here. It's not like old pilots where you've got a big problem because you'd have to pay the SAG fees to all the actors if you were going to release the Tremors pilot or whatever. You couldn't really do that because the juice wouldn't be worth the squeeze, because you've got to pay everybody their SAG fees.
I was going to make a reference to is it David Lynch, Eraserhead, where Jack Nance goes through a door. 4 years later, he actually enters the room. This is our tribute to that. And that's good, because the question that I wanted to ask you before we were interrupted was actually a David Lynch one, because you've also written a book on David Lynch. And I thought one of my fantasy unmade films would be the David Lynch. Is it... Is it Robbie Rockets or
Ronnie Rocket?
Ronnie Rocket, yes. So I wanted you to talk about that a little bit.
Well, as you may know, all attempts to synopsize David Lynch's script for Ronnie Rocket have ended in madness and death. So I can't really be sure that I could tell you accurately what it's about. And even when I interviewed one of the guys who was supposed to be in it back in, I guess, the late 70s, but when it was kind of first mooted, was Dexter Fletcher. And he couldn't really remember, except that it was about a little guy with a shock of red hair who'd been experimented on and had to plug himself into the wall every 15 minutes to kind of recharge. And he ends up joining a band, like it would have been a punk band, I guess, and becoming sort of a sensation. But then some terrible men in dark suits called the Donut Men. I can't say any more, because otherwise I risk as I say, madness and catastrophe. But it's pretty bad and pretty mad. Sorry, that was Freudian. I don't know if it would be on my wish list for, you know, if I turned up in an alternative universe one day, I don't think the first question I'd ask is, do you have Ronnie Rocket here? Did David Lynch ever make? But bless you for thinking that it was makeable. I think possibly the closest thing that we actually have in this universe to it may be Alex Proyas's Dark City combined with some of the little person parts of Twin Peaks.
Mm.
That feels like the right kind of vibe. And I think, you know, even though David Lynch was talking about Dexter Fletcher being Ronnie Rocket, I think really and truly, once he met, I can't remember the name of the actor who played the little person in Twin Peaks, but once he'd met that actor, I think there was only one person for him who could have played him. But I just, you know, I think it's one of those things where Lynch kind of moved on quite fast. You know, he went from kind of The Elephant Man to Dune. And I don't think there was any really serious intention to make that as his next film at any time except after Eraserhead, because I think he just, you know, his artistry as a filmmaker had started to develop beyond his artistry as an artist, and I think that took him into some fairly interesting places. By the time you got to 1986, he was doing Blue Velvet, and for me there was sort of there was no way back. And then of course, you know, when he 30 years later, when he was doing his kind of experimental films, that's when you got to he got back to a place where he was doing things like that were a little bit more in that Ronnie Rocket zone again, some of the sort of post Inland Empire at web stuff. And
yeah, with the bunny rabbits and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, exactly. It was that kind of wildly surreal stuff, you know.
Michael J. Anderson's the name of the guy. I just Googled it. Yes, I'm not going to claim any any knowledge. but they had a huge falling out, I think, or at least Michael J. Anderson sort of posted loads of things on Facebook about David Lynch. Well, accusations of child murder and stuff like that, really quite extreme stuff.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so because I'm not sure if he was just disappointed that he wasn't being cast in Twin Peaks: The Return, or if there was something deeper there, but there was definitely a heated exchange from the part of Michael Anderson. I don't remember reading any reply from David Lynch.
Yikes. Oh, I'll have to look into that. One of the things about spending, like, you know, a year doing a book like the Lynch book or the Kubrick book is that I tend to sort of jettison all, not interest in, but I don't tend to look any further behind the scenes of those, because you imagine when you're spending a year on one topic, as you may know, it kind of tends to be, it's so completely dominating that you almost can't look at a Lynch film again for another sort of 10 years, you know, weirdly, because you've just kind of saturated yourself in it completely, which is a perfect way to ruin something for yourself, is to kind of write a book about it, but then you sort of slowly come back around. But then I wouldn't necessarily want to go back behind the scenes. But one thing I do remember is that because my having those twin obsessions of David Lynch and films that never got made, when I got to interview Lynch for the book, which was which happened in Prague in person while he was mixing Mulholland Drive, it had basically taken me about 6 months to get the interview, and I finally got it because his assistant called and said, oh, I'm really sorry, David's not going to be able to do the interview because he's going to be in Europe, like while he's doing sort of post-production on Mulholland Drive. And I was like, well, I'm in Europe, and she sort of couldn't think of how to get out of it. So I got on a plane to Prague, and he arrived, and basically I thought, so I was interviewing him the next day, and I thought, shall I have a night out in Prague, or shall I like do my job properly and stay up really late at night writing questions for the interview that I'm going to do at, like, you know, 3 o'clock in the afternoon tomorrow? And I thought, you know what, I better do my questions. So I did my questions the night before, and obviously I had waited 6 months, so I had every single thing. This was about a week away from the book's deadline. I had every single thing I wanted to ask him, including about all these unmade projects. And then he woke me up the next morning and said, hi, is that David? This is David. I'm downstairs. We have to do the interview now because I'm a smoker, see? And I was like, what is happening? I've been woken up by this mad, shouty Gordon Cole character who's saying, come downstairs, we've got to do the interview now, because he's a smoker. I never figured that out. So I go down to you know, the breakfast canteen or whatever. He's sitting there with Angelo Badalamenti, who's sipping coffee in that very intimidating Mulholland Drive kind of way that wasn't even a reference yet, because I hadn't seen Mulholland Drive. Anyway, and I just basically dumped over the next couple of hours, I dumped questions on him about all these unmade things. I said, like, so what was the deal with that film that you were going to make with Neil Gaiman called Up at the Lake? And he would be like, I don't really remember. And then I said, well, luckily I interviewed Neil Gaiman and I asked him about it, and here's what he said. So I kind of wouldn't let him off the hook, because I knew that he was just gonna like flim flam me and say, yeah, that was never really a thing. But I had everything ready to go. So I think it's somewhere in the back of the complete Lynch, you know, now sadly long out of print, but may still be available as an ebook, that there's a big and perhaps definitive list of all those films that Lynch didn't get to make, because I made sure I had them all ready to go when I finally sat down with him.
That's an amazing, congratulations on your David Lynch impersonation, which is perfect, I'd have to say. Absolutely perfect. I'm a
you
smirker.
Have to, if you Patreon me, I will sing MacArthur Park in the style of spoken word David Lynch.
No,
I'm just kidding.
Have you, I listened to his autobiography, Room to Dream, last year, and it's
oh, fantastic.
I really would advise people to actually listen to the audiobook, because it has chapters by his biographer, essentially, which are fairly straight biography, and then there's chapters which he just basically covers the same period but with anecdotes and stuff, and it's just hilarious. I mean, there's a bit where he's talking about school and you can tell he goes off script, because he sort of goes, when I went to school, oh, it was a fucking waste of time. It was a fucking waste of my time. He's still angry. You know,
like, amazing. You know, amazing. Yeah.
Complete waste of my time.
So he's angry, and which is the, because he's shouty at the best of times. So angry and shouty. I imagine that's quite a treat.
Yeah, and it's sort of shoutiness, but without sort of nastiness to it. Weirdly,
I actually did visit his school, the art school that he went to in Philadelphia. Just because while I was working on the book, by coincidence, I was in Philadelphia for work, which was handy. So I went to his kind of alma mater. But I don't know if he's referring to his kind of small town school in Spokane, Washington, or whether he actually didn't get much out of art school. But I would challenge that theory, because I think he probably did, although, you know, artists do tend to sort of outgrow their schooling, because you have to kind of strip away the establishment idea of what an artist is supposed to be.
I'm pretty sure it was the more conventional sort of school that he went to, rather than the, I think it was just the practice of sitting, you know. I mean, sometimes schooling is more about teaching, and I say this as someone who's taught, is teaching children how to be bored, you know, in a quiet way,
right?
And I think there's,
and also you can't smoke,
I'm a smoker,
potentially a massive problem.
I'm trying mine out now.
That wasn't bad. Not bad. Yeah, no, the smoker thing, I eventually figured out it was because for some reason it meant he'd arrived by train overnight from Paris to Prague, because you could no longer smoke on the plane.
Right.
And he used to only fly Air France, because you could still smoke on Air France flights, like right up to the kind of mid 1990s or something. But then they'd even kind of stamped that out on Air France flights. So he'd arrived earlier than expected. Otherwise, that would have been one of those great David Lynch mysteries. Why have we got to do the interview now? Because I'm a smoker. Okay. So
like his films, it makes sense in the end. It all makes sense in some sort of
way.
Yes,
absolutely. So you're going to ask me for a book recommendation, aren't you?
That's right.
Yes. I have to say, I've been mostly reading, or rather listening to, because like the Lynch memoir you mentioned, which I haven't listened to yet, but I'll get right on that. I've been enjoying the memoir by Gabriel Byrne, which is kind of part life memoir and it's kind of salted with, but again, you know, if you're not listening to that so that you hear it read in Gabriel Byrne's kind of mellifluous, you know, Irish brogue, then you haven't really experienced that book as it should be experienced. And I'd say that most of the books that I've been reading lately, most of the film books I've been reading have been on the memoir or biography side of things. I've really enjoyed Mark Harris's biography of the filmmaker
Mike Nichols.
I've forgotten his name. Mike Nichols, yes. And the biography of Robin Williams.
Mm.
But I think the The book that I've enjoyed the most this year is probably Helen O'Hara's Hollywood, Women versus Hollywood. And I think you've probably, you've spoken to her for an episode of your podcast, I would think. I really, that was really fantastic because I think it opened up such a rich kind of theme of the early decades of women in Hollywood and the, you know, horrific things some of them went through in that period. And I felt that she just kind of lifted the veil on that stuff. And I really wanted to find out more because it was stuff that I had no idea had kind of gone on. And I found that completely fascinating. But I also wanted to give a shout out to the book which got me into screenwriting because that was a very important book, even though it's not a sort of film book per se, but the book Three Screenplays by Richard Price was basically after I'd read like a bunch of screenwriting books and found that it hadn't really kind of helped me actually get started. That book was so liberating because I was about 2/3 of the way through it when I thought, I think I know how to do this now. Mm. And basically he'd kind of just by the ease that how easy he made it look. And by the way that he just kind of formatted for readability and everything, it kind of demystified the screenplay. And I, you know, that's probably not that easy to find these days, but I really recommend reading, you know, if you can track down those books of screenplays, I've found them over the last kind of 30 years to be so much more helpful than books about screenwriting. So, you know, even if you have to read the kind of classic screenwriting books, I would urge you to read scripts published officially or otherwise, because that really is the best insight into not only, you know, how to format scripts and, you know, how the greats kind of write screenplays, but also what's happening in screenwriting now. You know, when you read a modern screenplay, you'll be amazed at how much things have changed over the past 5 years and 10 years, and that there's a new kind of language of screenplays that is right for now. And we're still kind of taking advice from, you know, people who were writing their screenplay books 25 and 30 years ago. And, you know, things move on pretty fast. So anyway, sorry, you're looking for one recommendation, but I just wanted to kind of blurt out a bunch of things that I've liked lately.
Most people so far have given multiple answers for that question, and I'm perfectly happy because ultimately it's what it's about. It's about people who are listening, getting recommendations, jotting them down, and going out and searching. So the more the merrier, really. I would second the Helen O'Hara book, Women versus Hollywood. I'd also second the Gabriel Byrne book, which I also listened to in an audiobook. You know, why wouldn't you? I mean, it's Gabriel Byrne. It's like one of the most beautiful voices since Richard Burton, you know,
Absolutely. I just found out today that Matthew McConaughey, even though it's published in October, that Matthew McConaughey has narrated the audiobook of his memoir. So I've just got that, and that will be my next listen after the Lynch one. So there's plenty more going on there.
It is a really daft book. It's a really, really.
I can't wait.
I know. I mean,
absolutely can't wait. It
lives up to your expectation of how he. I think he includes something. This isn't a spoiler, but he includes something in the book. And again, I listened to the audio version, which are like sort of moments of Matthew McConaughey zen, where he goes, it's a green light, because it's the title of the book. And he sort of just has these moments where he goes, green light. You know, always remember, don't smoke cigarettes or they smoke you, or some jibble jabble stuff. You know, it's just lunacy, nice. But very amusing lunacy.
It sounds super fun.
Absolutely. Well, listen, David, thanks so much for your time. It's been really great talking to you.
You too. Yeah, thanks for having me. And I'm looking forward to listening to more episodes.
So that was my conversation with David Hughes. Hope you enjoyed it. We had a great discussion also about screenplays and his book recommendations, which I heartily concur with. The screenplays of Richard Price, Mike Nichols' biography by Mark Harris, and Helen O'Hara, friend of the podcast, her book Women versus Hollywood. Thank you very much for listening. please remember to follow me on Twitter at Dr. Jonty, DrJonty. Thanks very much to Elliot Atkins for the music, and Ali Harwood for helping out with the art. I will talk to you. I will see you. Next week. Take care.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.